We are going to be in the end of Luke 22 today, and then kind of take off a chunk of chapter 23 as we go through. But we're getting to the end now as we're kind of nearing the close and approaching Easter. And our goal really is to arrive on Easter Sunday in our moment of resurrection that's going to take place in this gospel. Every gospel, we've got these four gospels written, each with a purpose, each with a, let's just call it like an authorial intent, that each gospel was written by somebody for a specific purpose. Sometimes we forget that. And Luke tells us right off the bat why he's writing this gospel for us. Does anybody remember this? Does anybody want to just take a guess who he's writing it to? This is 5 points. $5 at Starbucks if you get it right. Some of you are like flipping there. Theophilus. Theophilus is possibly somebody who commissioned Luke even to write kind of the opus of what took place. He writes really a two-volume book, the first being the Gospel of Luke and the second being the Gospel or the Book of Acts, and that these two are actually A and B of the same book. And he writes it for Theophilus for this purpose and this intent, that Theophilus would know. He says, you've been taught these things, but I'm writing so that you would know this with certainty in your heart. This idea of knowledge, it's way more than you've got all the facts or you've got these things kind of in order and organized that you've got an A on the test. No, he's going, I want you to know these things, which in Scripture was always has a sort of relational texture to it. It's not like that you've got a sort of knowledge of the structure of these pews, but that you're like sitting back into it. Does that make sense? That it's an experiential knowledge always. And what comes with that, like there's a serenity, a peace, a texture to this sort of knowledge. And see, I think sometimes we forget that in this day and age, that knowledge for us has almost a sort of leverage to it. It's got a power that allows us to feel that wonderful, euphoric feeling of being right. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Doesn't it feel good to be right? But the whole posture of being right, if we're honest, is something like a closed fist, something that we clutch to tightly. And see, knowledge, I think in Scripture, the knowledge that we're being encouraged towards is this sort of restful assurance that comes of standing on something that is stable. And when we do, the fruit of it is gentleness. The fruit of it is goodness. The fruit of it is love. And so this story, Luke is writing that we too might have this same sort of knowledge, the same sort of confidence of faith. I read this the other day, and I like this, just the simple. This is, I got this from Richard Rohr, but he actually may be stealing it from AA. But he says, most people do not see things as they are, rather they see things as they are. Have you heard this? It's probably worth reading again. Most people do not see things as they are, rather they see things as they are. And isn't this true? That so often we forget the fact that we see through a lens. As Scripture would say, we see through a mirror dimly. That as we look, there are things that distort our view. And whether that's emotions or bias or woundedness, self-preservation, need for control, jealousy, any of these things have a way of distorting what we see. And a statement like this, I think the punch comes from the fact that he's acknowledging something that we too easily forget. That most of us walk around feeling like we see things as they are. Don't you agree? Like I pretty much, you know, what I see is the truth. It's the reality. Instead of this important reminder that there are things within me that will cloud and veil the interpretations, twist it in such a way, and I won't even see myself doing that. Often it has something to do with the emotions that I'm caught up in. A need to be right, a need to feel like I have things sorted. Gosh, there's nothing like parenting to show you this, right? When you come in and you're addressing your kid, and you're right, you know, as I'm talking to my son or to my daughter, I'm right. Except there's all this other stuff going on in Jeff as I do. Like, listen, nobody talks to me that way, right? That kind of thing that all of a sudden, where is the energy coming from? And Jesus is going into this last chapter, and we're reminded again and again by Luke that he's in control of events, that other people, he's being betrayed by his friends, and yet Jesus is aware of what will take place and walks willingly into those situations. And we've seen this beautiful moment of prayer where Jesus in the garden is wrestling with what has to be done, wrestling with what's ahead of him, where he prays so beautifully and honestly, if there's any other way, let's do that. There's got to be another way. And Jesus sees with clarity all that lies ahead. And he pleads with his Father, like, come up, what's plan B? Let's go with that. And then he says that incredibly beautiful prayer, but in the end, not my will, but your will be done. I think what we're going to see as we go through our text, that the victory was won right there. That from that moment on, things are different. And Jesus is seen in his humanity with total clarity of heart. We see like a fixed sort of determination that we're going to, as we walk through these next sections, we just watch Jesus composed and in total freedom, standing firm in the midst of all kinds of chaos. He's been arrested by the Sanhedrin. And these are not just religious leaders. These are pretty much the Jewish kind of aristocracy. They're the ones that have the control or the power in a limited way under the oppression of Rome. They would have been religious leaders, but they also would have been people that had a good deal of money and influence. And so in Luke 22, we're going to finish the last part of this chapter and then carry on into 23. It says, when day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council, and they said, if you're the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. So they all said, are you the Son of God then? And he said to them, you say that I am. Then they said, what further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips. Now, if you read Mark's gospel, he kind of includes those two questions into one. But I like how Luke separates them because they're two very different questions. Are you the Christ and are you the Son of God? Now, Christ was much more of like a political statement than anything. Are you the prophesied king, right? And this is important for them because you have this Sanhedrin with their whole intention right now is to get Jesus executed. But they can't. They don't have the power. They can lead these like little arrests and they can kind of facilitate these small matters. But when it comes to those sorts of judgments, it's beyond their ability. And so they haven't been granted that sort of authority. So they go, are you the Christ? Why does this matter? Well, because Rome is going to care about that. Rome doesn't care if you call yourself divine. They just don't want you threatening the throne. So they say, are you the Christ? Just tell us. But he says to them, like, I could tell you, but you won't believe it, right? They're not asking this question. They're asking, let me say this, they're asking the right questions. These are the two questions they should be asking. But what we see in that cloudedness, seen as they are, they don't want Jesus to be. They don't care. They've already decided that Jesus, the question is he the Christ or is he the Son of God, irrelevant. They look at him and they go, we know what you are and you're a threat. You're a threat to our control. You're a threat to the privilege that we hold with the people. And as you come in this popularity and as you rally the masses behind you, we're not having it. We are the religious authority, not you, not some upstart that hasn't graduated from the schools we have. He's just coming in and stirring up the people, threatening our role. We're here to get rid of you. Jesus says you won't do two things. You won't listen to the truth, but also if I ask you a question, you won't answer. And here you see the political mindset where they're not going to put anything on record, anything that they could be held accountable to. And then Jesus says this really interesting statement, and I love it. He says, but from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God. And once again, Jesus gives these little clarifying things, like, guess what? Like, I outrank you guys in judgment. Just so you know. And it's not like after I go to the cross and then after I resurrect, then I will be seated. Jesus is like, here it like kind of chokes me up. He's going, I already won. This is over. And you realize what happened in the garden. And Jesus is surrendering of himself to God's will. And in the wrestling that took place in that amount of time, there was a victory that was won. And Jesus is like, it's as good as done. I'm seated at the right hand of the power of God. Just so you know, you are not in control of this moment. I am. And they go crazy and they're like, that's all we need to hear. You're saying that you're the Son of God? And Jesus says, you say that I am. And I love that. Like, here's Jesus going, I could answer, but it won't help. I could ask you questions, but you won't answer. And he's going, why would you even ask me that question? You've seen everything you need to have seen. The problem is not a lack of evidence here. It's a lack of openness. They've seen everything. It's been done right before their eyes. This from John 18. Is that the next slide? This is from the same little interview here. John's going to give us a few more details. He says, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus answered, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? And I think even here, Jesus, there's a sort of pleading, like what would it take? Why would you even say these things unless you yourself have seen the evidence? And yet what we see once again is it's not a lack of evidence that's created the problem. That their hearts are hard. And so much of really the understanding of knowledge, it's not just a matter of what's in here. It's a matter of how the heart and the head come together. Both of these things actually make up the mind. That it's not just your brain, that there's actually an emotional component of this that is critical. In fact, so often is the thing for us that's driving everything. They hear this, they're offended, and they go, all right, we're taking him to Pilate. We've heard enough. And so in 23:1-7, it says, and the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. And Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered, you have said so. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, I find no guilt in this man. Now, we've talked about this, how Luke kind of breaks things down and gives us just sort of the bare facts. But we see three accusations here. He's stirring up the people. Two, he doesn't pay tribute to Caesar, which is just a lie, right? They tried to get him, remember, they tried to get him on that earlier. Like, should we pay to Caesar? And Jesus is like, yeah, sure. Give him his little coins, right? If that makes Caesar happy, give it to him, right? But you give to God what is his. He doesn't pay tribute to Caesar, and he is saying that he himself is Christ, a king. And Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Now, Jesus would not have been the only one who had claimed such a thing. Interesting, like so much of our history from this time we get from a man named Josephus. But Josephus had made mention of other people that were rebels, that were creating these sort of terrorist bands against the Romans. And they would refer to them often, these people that were heading up these bands would refer to themselves as the King of the Jews. And so Pilate's asking Jesus, is that who you are? Are you this rebel rouser? As he's looking at this man who's totally at peace, responding in meekness in this situation. Nothing about Jesus is threatening at this point. Jesus says this in John's gospel. He says, do you have Jesus answered? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom's not of this world. Then Pilate said to him, so you are a king. Jesus answered, you say I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and this purpose I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? And we've seen the Sanhedrin, the religious leaders, closed off, hearts not open to the truth. But here you see with Pilate something different, a heart that has become cynical and jaded. Jesus is saying, hey, I've come to bring the truth. And Pilate's going, truth is irrelevant. All that matters is what allows you to bring a sort of control and calm. This was Pilate's role. This is the role that he served, was basically the one that had to keep order in Jerusalem. And at a time where all of a sudden the whole Hebrew people had gathered within the city for this moment of Passover, Pilate is on full alert. He's brought more troops in. All he wants to do is keep the peace. Who cares about what's true? All that matters is how people are going to respond and can you contain it? And so he's looking at this situation, and Jesus is offering Pilate the truth. He's standing before, and Pilate sees it. He's looking at Jesus and he's going, this guy's clearly he's innocent. Not only innocent, but brilliant. And as he's looking at Jesus, he's going like, look, I can't give these guys what they want, but back up a slide, horse, to the one more. Go back one. Sorry, I got you. In this situation that you've got the Pharisees there and arguing, pushing, they say he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee even to this place. And Pilate hears this and asks whether this man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. Everybody's in Jerusalem. But you see Pilate in this moment, he's looking at Jesus and he's going, okay, clearly this thing's a sham. This guy's innocent. They've already been beating him up. Clearly this guy is no threat. What do I do? And they throw out this term, well, he's Galilean. And Pilate thinks, okay, good. All Pilate wants to do, and we see this at the end, is just wash his hands of this. How do I get rid of this guy who's sitting here proclaiming this sort of message of truth? How do I wash my hands of this? And he goes, ah, I'll send him to Herod. And so he does. He sends Pilate on. We're going to skip the next quote just for the sake of time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by vehemently accusing him. And Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. So our third sort of response, we get these, like all these trials, and Luke is stacking these up to show, again, here's the claims of truth, what is getting in people's way. We see the Sanhedrin, hard-hearted. We see Pilate, cynical. And then we see Herod, which is so interesting. Herod, like the narcissistic glutton. And Herod's like, oh, cool, Jesus? Yeah, send him in here. I want to see him do one of those things that he does. Like, do heal somebody, Jesus. Like, do that thing. And I think for Pilate, he's just going, oh, Jesus, yeah, he's a total celebrity. Let me, like, I want that guy on my side. So he brings him in and he's like, hey, do one of your things. And he questions him at some length, but he made no answer. Okay, I love this. You see Jesus with Pilate and he's responding. He's even making an appeal, stating to Pilate, no, this is who I am. Like, yes, I'm a king, but not of this world. Herod comes in and goes, do one of your tricks. And Jesus goes, says nothing. And Herod starts to fume. Like nobody just shuts him out. And you see just like the rage in Herod. And he goes, I know what I'll do. I'll mock you. And that will feel really good. I'm going to make you look like a fool. How dare you? How dare you withhold from me? Do you know who I am? And Herod, in this like deep insecurity, responds by just bullying. He's like, I'm not going to beat you like the Sanhedrin. I'm going to ridicule you. I'm going to spit on you. I'm going to mock you in front of all these people. And you see, here's Herod, the quote king, doing this with them. It's not like he just said, yeah, have your way with Jesus. Go ridicule him. Herod's caught up in it. And see, this is the thing. When you think about truth, seeing things as they are, what clouds us? You see all these people with so much going on in their hearts. And who knows what's going on in Herod's? Well, we do. When he was confronted, this is the same guy who was confronted by John the Baptist and he had him killed because John the Baptist wouldn't say it was okay for him to leave his wife and marry another. And somebody who cannot handle the conviction of truth, that at all, with all of his strength, he's trying to silence it, to quash it, to get rid of the truth. This is somebody who hates truth and loves the sort of false reality that he's created. And Herod behaving in this way where his ego is just flourishing, not only mocks Jesus, but actually becomes friends with his enemy. Isn't that such an interesting little bit there? And I think you see a lot of this, like these like weak sort of alliances of intimacy where people decide to hate the same person together. Makes us feel close. It's like, that's the sweetness of gossip, right? When you get together and you both bash on that other person or them or those people. And you go, oh, don't we feel so close right now? We both dislike the same people. It's a false sort of intimacy. But I think sometimes we're so desperate for a sense of like our own rightness as well as that connection that we'll take it any way we can. And that's it. Herod can't say that Jesus is guilty. All he can do is ridicule him, sends him back, and all of a sudden Pilate ends up with Jesus once again on his door. And in verse 13, it says, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, you brought me this man as one who is misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him. Like he knows he's got to do something. This is again, Pilate, like justice irrelevant. He's like, I can't bring myself to accuse him of what you're saying because it's so obviously a lie. But what if we just beat him up a little bit? Will that be enough to satisfy you? But then in verse 18, it says, but they all cried out together, away with this man, release to us Barabbas. a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." A third time he said to them, "Why? What evil has he done? I've found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. I think this is just an interesting sort of close to this. This is as far as we're going to go in our passage today, and I know it's been a little bit of a fire hose. What we see in there, and it's not as clearly stated by Luke, but we see the mob now. That as the Sanhedrin is pressing and pressing, they get the people riled up. They create so much pressure on Pilate that he folds. And in other Gospels, we know he tries to wash his hands at this point, but you could just see him trying to wash off this stain that won't go away. He just wants this problem to be gone. But he's accountable. And so are all of them. And so is the crowd. He delivered Jesus over to their will. That's such an interesting way of putting it. But they get the desires of their heart. I mean, the ultimate hypocrisy is that they choose an insurrectionist over Jesus. As they come in this plea for justice, they set free a notorious criminal, and in the end, plead to crucify the one who's come to save them and will continue to follow that path towards freedom for their sake. I just think even the fact that they're crying out crucify, which is this Roman method of torture and humiliation. You see how in this they're pleading for some sort of freedom, right? The deep bondage that they find themselves in. And see, this is the thing when Jesus is talking about setting us free. The thing that most of us need more than anything is to be set free from ourselves and our own bondage to our heart. I've said this before, but I love this story about how G.K. Chesterton was asked the question. A number of authors were asked this question by the London Times, "What's wrong with the world?" And he responded back and just said, "I am." And here on every level, the truth comes in, and what we see is resistance, whether it's cynicism or it's hard-heartedness or it's self-indulgence. All of these things have created this lens of distortion where they cannot see the truth. What's wrong with this world? I am. How do I respond to the truth? And think about that. How do you respond when it challenges you? How do you respond when it convicts you? How do you respond when it puts you on the defensive? We've just seen Peter in this moment fail so badly. And yet in the end, it's going to become his authority as he repents. And reluctantly, but and with some level of embarrassment and shame, brings himself humbly back to this place of mercy and forgiveness and grace. This is how we're set free. Not by holding it all together, not by doing everything right. Freedom comes in this place of asking forgiveness, in humbling ourselves, in surrendering ourselves. And it is so counterintuitive because everything in us wants control. Everything in me wants applause. I just want applause. I don't want to ask forgiveness. I don't want to be convicted. I want to be affirmed. I don't want to be told, "Jeff, you're good enough." And see, that's not love. That's flattery. The true friendship is one that can come in and speak that truth even when it makes me squirm a bit. And says, "Jeff, you're out of your integrity here. You're doing things that are beneath you." And God is saying, no, I've called you to something higher. How do you respond to truth? And what I love is I think that we've just seen Jesus model for us. How do you do this? How do we respond right? How do we see clearly? And we go back to the garden. And there's Jesus telling his disciples, do these two things. Here's two things. Just watch and pray. Keep your eyes open. And keep your heart and your posture low. Jesus, in those honest prayers in the garden, sweats blood. There's a name, let me see if I can pronounce it right. Hematridosis. He's not actually sweating blood. He's just actually sweating that much, sweating profusely to the point where capillaries break and his sweat becomes the color of blood. It's funny because they probably in this didn't know what in the world was happening to Jesus, but it's now a condition that we've seen. And you know who it happens to? It happens to people that are about to be executed. And here's Jesus. You want to know how he feels in the garden? I'm just going to speculate here. But I'm guessing he feels afraid. I bet you he's terrified. And in that posture of what lies before him, he wrestles. There's got to be another way. But in the end, not my will, but your will be done. And that act of surrender, as he says, I trust you. His Father has laid out this course and he says, I'm committed, I'll do it. Even at the cost of my own safety, even at this experience of excruciating pain, I'll do it. And that we would look at, the ego would look at that like bondage, to give up your will. And yet what we find, and this is just the radical shift that we're seeing here, is God is saying that is the way to freedom. When you surrender that small part of yourself, all of a sudden now, you're living in the light. You're living in reality. You're seeing clearly. This is why Scripture is going to say, look, it's about these two things. It's about wisdom, which requires a fear of the Lord. And just as much or intertwined with that is understanding. And that comes in this posture of humility. True openness, going, God, wherever you lead. After Lincoln had they basically won the war and the Civil War was at an end, he gave a speech out of a desire to unite the people. And he said, we can succeed only by concert. It's not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise. Rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. And this line, this is what I love. He says, we must disenthrall ourselves. And disenthrall means to be set free, but you think of it as the opposite of being enthralled, which is this sort of spellbound, right? You get caught up. And I love how Lincoln's saying, as we navigate new territory, we need to think in a way where we are disenthralled. And where the emotions and the things that grab us, the anxiety that grips us, all of these things, we are able to surrender and let them go. I have some questions for us as we reflect. Number one, how is it that you resist truth? And we all do. All of us do. Do you insist on being right? Do you dismiss and degrade those who view different than you? Do you ignore information you don't like? Ask yourself, what am I defending? What am I afraid of? Why am I so offended? As Herod mocks and Jesus just stays quiet. Sin happens when we put our desires or control over God's. It shows us where we are out of alignment. What is God asking you to trust him with? What needs to be surrendered? And three, where is God asking you to grow? How might this growth be setting you free? So I want to close with a little quick exercise. But think of what is stressing you out right now. Think of what you are clinging to. And then I want you to do this. I just want you to hold your hands out. I want you to just hold that thing as tight as you can. You got it? You can close your eyes if you want. It doesn't matter. You can keep them open. But what is it? What are you afraid of? It's tax season. Maybe it's that. Something in the world, something going on, something with your children, something out of your control. Just cling to it. Do you feel that in the palm of your hand? Do you feel that in your arms and in your shoulders? It's no wonder that when people ask us how we're doing, we're busy or we're tired. And then imagine these hands underneath yours. And Jesus is saying, I want you to just give it to me. I want you to let it go. So when you're ready, just go ahead and drop it. And do you feel that? Do you feel what that feels like? That's freedom. And those hands are under yours going, I got it. I got it. Jesus is saying, not my will, but yours be done. And the Father says, we got this. And to all of us, those things that are clouding us, distorting us, those things that we hold to so tightly, those are idols. They end up holding us back and keeping us small, but as we release it. So hold your hands out now. And as we close, I just want to pray that God would bless you. And keep you and fill you. God would make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. That God would lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Amen.